This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 225 for December 3rd, 2009. Same origin troubles. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you as you surf the world on the World Wide Web. Mr. Steve Gibson is here. He is the man behind the Gibson Research Corporation, creator of SpinRite. You know, I was looking at your... Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo, it's great to be with you again. You know, we don't have a jingle, and I guess that's a good thing.
Because yeah, no, you
that would sort of be distracting, like you do with Dick DiBartolo, to be like talking over jingles that were going in the background.
You've got viruses, and Steve's got the cure. He's a man. No, that doesn't fit. It doesn't. I was looking at your Wikipedia entry, and the funniest, I mean, it's so funny to watch the discussion behind the scenes, because there are people... I think it's one guy, but there's somebody who doesn't like you.
Yeah.
And somebody questioned calling you an engineer. And I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to, like, get on there and say, what do you mean, is he an engineer? The guy, for crying out loud, he built the light pen for an Apple II. He's,
yep.
I mean,
the blew Wozniak away. I remember that Steve Wozniak was at the Apple Fest, in the Boston Apple Fest, and he stood there. I loved the pronoun he used. He looked up, and as I was demonstrating the light pen, and he said, "You always blow me away with what you're able to get my machine to do."
Oh, isn't that nice?
He was possessive about it. I thought that's really neat.
Well, that's also from Woz. Very high praise.
Yeah, and the real trick of engineering was that whereas all light pens of that era were big cigar tube size things.
I remember, yeah.
Mine was the size of a regular little pen, and I had figured out how to mount the amplifier at the other end, back in the Apple. And I used something called a transconductance amplifier because the photodiode, you had to use a photodiode, not a phototransistor, because of the response time. A transistor's amplification makes it way too slow to respond to the beam moving past in front of the screen. The photodiode can do that. But the problem is then you have to count electrons, literally almost like a photomultiplier.
Wow.
And to do that at the end of a 4-foot cord and to put the amplifier in the Apple, which is a noisy environment. Anyway, I guess it was a feat of engineering. So, yeah. I think I qualify as an engineer. So
probably some people listening have no idea what a light pen is. In the days before styluses and touch screens, you use light pens, right?
Yeah, well, I would say the day before the mouse, because...
You predated the mouse, too. You're right, yeah.
Yes, exactly. The idea was, I think it dated from maybe like NORAD or, you know, high-end display systems, and you'd, you know, because I remember like in early movies that were showing like military complexes, there'd be people in uniform like touching the screen with a pen. And the idea was, and those were old XY displays where the beam jumped around all over the screen, like painting air traffic control diagrams and things. And so you could, if you touched the pen to where something was on the screen, the system would notice where the beam was when the pen said, "Oh, I just saw the beam go by." And that was a way of feeding back coordinates into the computer. So, yeah, and I mean, it was my first real independent corporate success was the light pen for the Apple II. And actually, there were some tremendous articles that were you know, very flattering about how well it worked.
Really,
and in fact,
clever.
Atari bought it from me because they wanted it for their Atari.
I didn't know that was yours. I remember the Atari light pen.
I wrote all the software for it, too.
I'll be danged.
Yeah.
Wait, and part of the discussion was interesting, which is, well, what constitutes an engineer? How do you... You know, do you have to have a degree in engineering to be an engineer? I mean, that doesn't make sense. An engineer is somebody who designs and builds stuff.
Yeah, I think of myself, I mean, sort of both scientist and technologist. I think of a technologist as an applied scientist. You know, I like, you know, creating things.
Right. Well, that's what engineering is. It's applied science.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we often talk about that on the network because it's one of the reasons we're doing more science stuff with Ray and with Kiki, because I think people forget the strong bind between science and technology.
Yeah. And it was probably the Windows XP raw sockets thing that upset.
That's when you made enemies.
That's when I made enemies.
And
I
you mean, were right.
I was right, but that doesn't really count.
I mean, that's the funny thing. Even Microsoft acknowledged, finally, yeah, it was a problem, and took it out.
And fixed it, yeah.
But, you know, damage done. It's funny. I mean, when you see somebody saying, well, Steve's not an engineer, it's just you have to laugh at the person's crazy.
Yeah, well, I love stupid. Where people who have said, yeah, he's only ever written one program.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, have you been to GRC lately? It's like,
people often say things without any knowledge.
Yeah. You hear well, and time. The other thing, too, is the anonymity. We don't know who these right. people are. I mean, everybody who matters knows who I am and what I've done. But, you know, the net lets people with no pedigree whatsoever, you know, comment as, you know, as if they had some. It's like, oh, okay. I mean, I do what you do, Leo. Yeah. I just ignore it.
Brush it off. What are you going to do?
Yep.
What are you going to do? Somebody's pointing out in the chat room that Jeopardy uses a light pen and has since 1984.
Ah,
that's how the contestants sign the, you know, write their answer.
Ah, and sportscasters, weren't they doing things now?
Telestrator is essentially a light pen, yeah.
Right.
Although now I'm sure it's touch.
I would think
light.
So.
Yeah. Before we get to our subject, what is our subject, by the way?
Our subject is, it's as you wouldn't know from the title. Normally you do. The title is Same Origin Troubles. There's been I would say it qualifies as a kerfuffle in the security community, which was launched about the middle of November, so about 2 weeks ago, by a security outfit who claimed that they had discovered some flaws in Shockwave Flash, which made all websites that weren't specifically designed to protect against it vulnerable to user-uploaded content. And Adobe responded, and, I mean, there were articles in a number of major industry newspapers. SC Magazine had a comment. Computer World had a comment. Of course, the Register weighed in. And it brought to my attention the fact that we had never explicitly discussed same origin, because it's a fundamental security aspect of the internet that, unfortunately, most sites actually are not good about handling. So because it really is a problem, even though I would argue that sort of on Adobe's side, that it's not their problem, even though unfortunately Shockwave Flash is more permissive in a number of ways than it ought to be, I thought that would be a great thing to talk about, is, you know, this, the idea of the danger associated with user-uploaded content and how that danger can be mitigated by making sure that when you serve back user-uploaded content, you don't do it from the same origin as the content you trust. Because inherently, you should not trust user-uploaded content.
All right.
So wind up your propeller.
Yeah, no, this is very relevant.
It way is, yes.
Really great to talk about. Before we do that, I would like to, and we will have, of course, as always, our daily, weekly dose of security news, errata, updates, things like that.
And I have a nice Thanksgiving story.
Aw. So will we start, you want to start with errata, security news? Where do you want to start here?
Yeah, we got a bunch of security news.
Something, a little bit.
I wanted to make sure that everyone using Safari had updated themselves. Apple recently fixed multiple critical vulnerabilities, which affect both Mac OS X and Windows. There were multiple vulnerabilities in Safari's handling of just pretty much everything, a variety of web page scripting constructions and malicious images. There was an integer overflow error caused by improper handling of images containing an embedded color profile. It's interesting. Color profiles seem to be a problem for Apple. We've had a lot of mentions of color profile problems in the past. I don't know what's going on. Someone ought to really look at that code closely and say, okay, let's just fix these things once and for all. Yeah. Or who knows? Maybe they keep tweaking with it and messing it up, as you know, our old code, new code dilemma. Safari can be made to crash while parsing specially crafted XML content. And, of course, the concern was that a crash could be evolved into an attack, which is generally the way those things go. There was an error in Safari's handling of navigation, which could cause a specially crafted HTML file to load a local file and lead to information disclosure, which is not good, depending on what local file you load. They discovered that the way cross-origin, which is actually the topic of our content today, our podcast, the way cross-origin resource sharing was implemented in WebKit could result in cross-site request forgeries, which we've discussed in a separate podcast before. So that got fixed. And the way WebKit handles FTP directory listings could lead to arbitrary code execution, information disclosure, or at least application termination. So that all got wrapped up and fixed in the latest version of Safari. Now, I wrote 4.0.0, but I think I meant 4.0.4.
Let me check and see what because I'm sure I'm up to date.
Yeah.
I am running 4.0.4.
Ah, good. Then my memory was correct and what I wrote was wrong. So, yeah. Good. So everyone wants to be at 4.0.4. Not surprisingly, Internet Explorer, another one of our favorite troubled browsers, has a pretty bad zero-day remote code execution vulnerability. The bulk of the market share of IE is still at versions 6 and 7. Even though 8's been out for a while, 6 and 7 are the ones that are vulnerable. Interestingly, in Microsoft's extensive note, they've acknowledged the problem. They know they've got it. Hopefully, we'll get this fixed in December on December 8th, which is next, which will be the second Tuesday of December, and will be the patch Tuesday for December. I'm hoping this gives them time to fix it. In their extensive write-up, they said, "Well, but IE5." Isn't vulnerable.
It's like, five? Five?
I know. And in fact, they even had to say that 6 running on Windows 98 was vulnerable.
Oh, dear.
That won't get fixed anytime soon. But it turns out that there's a problem with the way CSS style objects are invoked, which surprised Microsoft. Exploit details and proof of concept of this exploit are on the net, so that makes it a zero-day exploit. And we often talked about the Metasploit framework, which is this framework that allows hacks to be created and deployed very quickly. The Metasploit framework exploit module 37085.rb will demonstrate this and allow people to do bad things to IE 6 and 7. And I think I remember reading that 6 and 7 still have like 80%+ of the IE market. So lots of people have not moved to 8. I mean, I was reluctant to do so. I waited a while, and pretty much now when I'm on one of my machines that's still on 7, it's like, okay, yeah, fine. I'll go to 8 now. I'm sort of getting used to it and the way it looks and so forth. And it's arguably more secure. Certainly in this case it is. So if anybody right now is still on 7, this might be a little good reason to kick yourself up to 8, which has become, I think, stable enough to use. In a little twist on Microsoft's second Tuesday of the month updates. Remember that last update was November's, and that it was a massive update, a huge
biggest
number
in history, right?
Yes, a huge number of things fixed, and it turns out
broken. No.
There is now the black screen of death.
Oh yeah, I've been seeing a lot about this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Apparently, Microsoft tweaked, in this massive update, some ACLs, those are access control lists, which govern what processes are able to read and write files and even registry keys in the registry. And Microsoft has acknowledged the problem. They're trying to track it down.
It's Windows 7 only, right?
Good question. It might very well be, although...
That was my sense, but I haven't done a lot.
Yeah, it might very well be Windows 7 only.
And, by the way, I don't think that widespread.
No, and that's what Microsoft is saying. It's like, okay, we're looking into it, but it's not. I mean, I've updated everything, although I'm not on Windows 7 yet, so it wouldn't have hit me. But yes, if this had been a huge problem, first of all, it would not have gotten through Microsoft's own pre-release testing, and the world as we know it would have come to an end if everybody with running Windows 7 had this happen. But certainly, apparently, maybe it relates to one particular graphics driver. I think I remember seeing some ATI Radeon something or other, where you could say, okay, well, I could see how that guy could slip through Microsoft's testing. But it's never good when the security updates that were being increasingly forced to install just out of our own instinct for self-preservation, when they go bad, that's not good. So
it just underscores the difficulty, though, that Microsoft faces with this huge variety of hardware that they run on.
Yes.
Testing is a nightmare.
It's phenomenally difficult, yes. And in a weird story that I just sort of picked up on...
Just briefly, Slash, the chat room is saying that on Slashdot.now, the story is being retracted.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Microsoft said they were investigating reports.
And this might be the Microsoft's result. This was a NeoWin report, and Microsoft said they hadn't seen broad issues. Okay, Previx, the guy who found it, has issued an apology. They blame malware for making changes to the registry, which causes this behavior. So they had malware on their system, making an even more oddball environment.
Interesting. So, so there was something bad there to start with, and then Microsoft security updates come along, changes some ACLs, and piss off the malware, and so now, other things don't work.
Yeah. Thank you to A. Villafane and Mike and the others who notified us of that.
Yep.
That just broke, so.
Cool. A pub in the UK, a bar, which is offering free Wi-Fi, free open Wi-Fi, was fined $13,000 by the copyright holder of some content that the copyright holder claims was illegally downloaded. And this caused a lot of news in the UK because, the idea of somebody offering free open Wi-Fi being sued as due to the conduct of somebody taking advantage of their open Wi-Fi service. I mean, that's something that, obviously would be huge if this were setting a precedent for the way the world's going to be moving forward. Now, there's pending legislation in the UK, which they call the Digital Economy Bill, which would provide protection because the business would be classified as a public communications service provider, which would make it exempt from litigation. That is, they would be considered a common carrier and not responsible for the actions of people using their service. And then some legal opinion was obtained, and the legal opinion came down that said that Wi-Fi hotspots in public and enterprise environments that provide access to the internet to members of the public, free or paid, are public communications services, which then would exempt them. But at the moment, there's not this legislation in place. And as far as I can tell, this fine is still in place. And I would imagine the pub has asked to remain anonymous and isn't discussing, isn't talking about the specifics, but it caught my attention because this does sort of, we're all massive users of Wi-Fi hotspots as we travel around with our laptops, hopefully keeping cognizant of security. But if this was setting a precedent, obviously, such that, people were using the hotspots to download illegal content and the hotspot providers were then coming under legal attack as a consequence of the actions of the people that they were offering the service to, well, that potentially really throws a monkey wrench in this whole notion of, you know, go to Starbucks and get free Wi-Fi or,
yeah, no kidding,
or wherever. So it'll be interesting to see how this gets handled. And then it does create, though, another problem, of course, if it's clearly made policy that there's a complete hold harmless and somebody offering such delivery system like open Wi-Fi isn't liable, then where is the liability? I mean, then you would go to an open Wi-Fi hotspot specifically to do your illegal things.
Well, but it's similar. It's similar to the safe harbor provided to internet service providers. If you're a pub owner, you're passing
right
along internet service. You're becoming an internet service provider. And I think that in the U.S. you would be protected. I think it's interesting the British tried to make a law against it. I don't know if that would hold up here. That's very interesting. It's a terrible precedent.
Yeah, and again, it looks like this digital economy bill, which is slated to pass, will fix the problem in the UK, which will be a good thing because, you know, and I hope these people don't pay their $13,000 fine until that happens, or they, you know, get some good counsel. And the last little bit of news on the reminding people not to click on links in email, especially if they appear to be IRS refund letter notices.
You got money!
Which I guess is attracting a lot of people. There's the so-called Zeus ZBot Trojan is now spreading very successfully, unfortunately, by so-called drive-by downloads. Email spam pretending to be an IRS refund letter is downloading the Trojan if recipients click on the link in the email without any additional user interaction. So they're leveraging some known vulnerabilities in whatever platform, presumably Outlook and that uses the IE viewer in order to download these things. So I it's always worth reminding people, no matter how good you've been in the past, you must still be good in the future, because these problems are not going away. And the IRS actually, this is enough of a problem that the IRS has issued a formal statement on their own site saying, we don't send email like that. So don't blame us. Don't click on the links. Just delete these things.
Yeah. Wow.
I just wanted to mention in the Windows versus Mac never-ending
war.
That I've been using a MacBook Pro for about the last month for many hours in the morning because I've been doing a bunch of PDP-8 programming.
Really? On a MacBook Pro?
Well, because that's where this really nice PDP-8 emulator is available.
Not on Windows.
There are some, but not nearly as nice.
Interesting. Huh.
And so as a consequence of this strange sort of drag me along kicking and screaming out of Windows over to the Mac, I've been using the Mac a lot for the first time in my life. And I just wanted to acknowledge that it's pleasant. I mean, there are things about
it. What did you think? It was like, oh, my God, it's going to be a nightmare.
No, I just thought it was kind of different and kind of romper roomy.
It's not that different. That's really the real message, I think, in this war is they're getting more alike all the time.
Yeah, except there are, for example, the fact that you can't grab any window edge that you can only resize from the lower right corner. It's like, okay, why?
Right.
But I like the way their user preferences is sort of like the equivalent of the Windows control panel. I just like the way that's integrated. The fact that the apps have they all share the menu bar at the top rather than each app having its own menu bar.
Because that's a big complaint people have.
Yeah. it's as a Windows user, it's a little unnerving because I'm not used to that changing. Once right. you get used to the idea that the window with focus changes that, then it's like, oh, okay, I get it. I don't quite understand. I've always been wanting to ask you, Leo, when I close something, it, you know, like I'll close Firefox. Well, the Firefox logo over in the whatever that thing is you call, like, you know, the dock.
Dock, yeah.
It's got a white dot next
it's
to
still
it.
Still open.
Which makes me feel like, okay, it's not really gone.
See, this bothers me about Windows. Windows does something to me that seems a little odd, which is you don't explicitly close an app. It closes itself after the last window is closed. And on the Macintosh, there's a quick command for every... And by the way, one of the things that's great about the Macintosh is the uniformity of menus. There's really a kind of a standard for how menus have work. And you can always say that on the menu, you know, there's the application's name. At the very bottom of that menu will always be a quit command. And it's always control or the command Q. So yeah, that's how you have to quit it. Closing the last window does not quit an application as it does in Windows. And that's confusing for Windows users, I understand.
And, okay, so when I'm confused.
But it makes sense to me because the window is not the application. The window is just a display window.
So, okay, so if I were to open other applications that needed the RAM, is the one that...
No, it's still running.
No kidding. Okay, well, I mean,
it always seemed odd to me that I never felt like the application was closed out in Windows because I closed the last window and now it is, I guess it's closed out, but I never explicitly said I'm done with this application. The Mac makes you say explicitly, no, I'm done with the application. Just because I closed the last window doesn't mean I'm not done.
Well, now in Windows, unless you're talking about
there is an explicit close command, I understand. Which is unaccountably Alt F4.
Oh, Alt F4. I'm there. I'm there, baby.
I think Command Q is a little more mnemonic, but okay, Alt F4. And you probably use Alt F4, but Windows also will close an application when you close its last window. And that's the behavior the Mac is not doing.
Okay, but the way you're saying that, applications are windows in Windows. That is.
No. You can have an application. You can have a TSR style application that's running without a window. Okay.
You can
sure,
have
indexes, things do that all the time. There is indexing going on in the background. There's always something going
well,
on.
Well, services, for example, are applications that don't have windows.
Right.
And you can have an application present multiple top-level windows, but normally a top-level window is an instance of an application. So, for example, if I launch Internet Explorer.
Right.
And I look in the task manager and I see iExplorer.exe. If I launch if I start another copy of Internet Explorer, I get another instance of iExplorer.exe. That is, it's actually multiple copies of the application are running. So when I'm closing Windows, I'm closing applications on a one-for-one basis in Windows. Instead of thinking of in terms of like closing the last window closing the application. Each one is actually an application.
Is an instance, yeah.
Is an instance of an application,
not
yeah.
that way on the Mac.
I get that now.
An application is instantiated when you run it and remains instantiated until you explicitly close it. The window is a view into the application, but it's not required for an application to be instantiated.
Interesting. Now
I did not realize that Windows...
Right.
Was so closely tied, the instantiation was so closely tied to a view.
Right.
All the views on Windows are the applications always have a view.
Yes. You can make an application have multiple windows,
right.
But normally the top level window is an application. And if you have multiples of those open, you've got actually multiple copies of applications.
Now, all of this gets a little moot with threading. And, you know, that was the thing that Chrome did that was interesting, was that each tab was an instantiation of the application.
So they could die separately.
Right.
Right. Or hang and get killed and so forth.
Now, remember, you know, you're a sophisticated user, and so an operating system is designed not for you. You understand what's going on under the hood. So the person who doesn't know what's going on under the hood... all they know is...
They don't even ask these questions.
Well, they do, because you go, well, I... because it's that's a one very subtle problem that switchers have. The more obvious problems is the buttons, the windows zooming, you know, growing a window and moving a window, but that's a subtle one that kind of bugs people. I think is that, well, wait a minute, I didn't on Windows, I didn't close that application. I just closed a window, and now the application's gone. And I don't feel like I'm like, are you sure it's gone? I don't know. There's no sign that it's there or not.
And I knew that it was around still because it would come back. If I clicked on the icon, bing, it's like, oh.
Right.
But I was thinking maybe it was like Apple was being clever and like leaving it in RAM, but preferentially, it's like other stuff came along and needed its memory since I had closed it technically. It was like, you know, just sort of being around quickly if I needed it.
Well, some stuff's probably locked, but most of it's purgeable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the memory manager is pretty sophisticated in OS X. I remember that the heritage of the Macintosh, which just might go back to it, pre-OS X days, the memory management was god-awful. And you really had a hard time reclaiming memory, and there was all sorts of issues.
Yeah,
and they were pretty good. They have a system very comparable to Windows now.
And when I think about it, you know, when like on the Finder icon, if you right click on it, it says, you know, open another Finder window.
Right.
Now the Explorer, the Windows Explorer, is that way. That is, you know, there's one copy of Explorer running, and then you could have like multiple views of your file system and your computer and so forth. But that's sort of an exception. Most of the other things in Windows, the so-called the top-level window, like the browser window, multiple tabs will live within that one application. But as you launch multiple apps, even multiple instances, those are actually separate applications. Separate application instances that start up and run. So
to me, the Mac way, I mean, I don't want to belabor this, makes more sense because it just reminds you that there are applications running without Windows. I have many applications running that don't have for instance, here's a little friend feed notifier that's running in the background. It pops up a window when there's something new on friend feed, but it doesn't have a window when there's, you know, it pops up a window and lets it go. I mean, Windows has many applications like that as well.
Sure.
So I just think I like to explicitly close an application because then I know it's closed. But that, you know, this is minor. My real point and the thing I tell people who want to engage in a war is this is like, you know, human and chimp DNA. There's 99.99% similarity between Macs and Windows.
Yeah, I like the power. Maybe it's just the comfort. Maybe it's the familiarity. To me, it Windows feels like more of a power user's experience. But I have to say, if and I'm noticing as I'm looking around, I'm seeing more and more Macs. Yeah. I mean, like Macs really seem to be coming on strong. And I mean, why wouldn't they? I mean, if you want to surf the web and do email and actually get work done and not be all obsessive about the OS itself, but just, you know, use a computer as a, you know, as a means of getting your work done rather than the, you know, it being the end itself, then I could easily recommend a Mac.
It's great for programmers because it comes with a very powerful programming environment.
In fact, yes, mine just updated Xcode. There was a major...
Xcode is amazing, yeah.
Yep.
And then you get Ruby, you get Python, you get Perl all built in, you know, comes with that. So I think it's a lot of geeks who want a terminal window. You know, they want the Bash, Unix, Bash shell.
The idea that it's got actual real Unix underneath it.
Exactly.
Is a compelling feature for many people.
But to each his own. They're all running on Intel chips. It's all, you know, it's all more similar than different, if you ask me.
Yeah. But it's very pretty. I like it.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say, I'd been using it for quite a while. It took a while to get used to it, to kind of customize it a little bit here and there. I fixed the caps lock so it's a control and overrode that because, you know, why?
Oh, yeah.
Caps lock.
Well, but by the way, it's easy to do in Windows. You have to install. In the Mac, you have to install a program on Windows to do that.
Yes.
Oh, I hate that caps lock key. Hate it.
I had an interesting little quick fun Thanksgiving story that I wanted to share. Literally on Thursday of Thanksgiving, an email was written by someone named Mark Schoonover, S-C-H-O-O-N-O-V-E-R, Schoonover. He said, "Happy Thanksgiving. as luck would have it, I'm out with the in-laws, and they asked me if this clicking they are hearing with their drive is anything to worry about. Well, it is. I can't read everything from the drive. I do own a copy of SpinRite, but it's at home, 365 miles away. I was hoping there was a way for me to download a copy, but I don't know my transaction ID / serial number to my licensed copy of SpinRite. Is it possible to look that information up? Here is my billing information. And then he gave his name and his street address and so forth. And he says, I know it's a holiday, but hopefully you're available. And then I noticed that in this little dialogue, it said, sent from my mobile device. So Sue, who runs GRC's operations side, you know, taxes, bookkeeping, and so forth, happened to check in on Thursday since she, like the rest of us, operate from home, so it's easy for her too. She wrote back and said, hi, Mark, how about an email address that you may have had when purchasing? Nothing is coming up under the address you wrote from. And he wrote back, well, it's possible I used, and then he gave a different address. That email address was before I used this personal email address. Thanks for the quick response. And then Sue wrote back, Mark, your original receipt with download instructions has just been sent via email. For your information, your transaction code and your email receipt is basically the keys to your account. It will allow you to obtain replacement copies as well as edit your contact email should it need ever be changed. Sincerely, GRC Sales Department. And then his final reply was, thanks again for handling this during a major holiday. Gotta love a company with great customer support. The great news is SpinRite saved the day. It managed to repair the problem in a single level 2 pass. I was able to get the system to restart, get the data off, then remove the drive from service. I'm now in good graces with my mother-in-law. Have a great Christmas. So, yep, we have that system. As long as you know your transaction ID, you can get it from our server anytime, wherever you happen to be. And if you don't, we can typically find it for you and send it to you. And then you can get it again.
Once again, SpinRite saves Thanksgiving. That's a nice story. And, yeah, I think there are probably more than a few people who went home for the holidays who were called to duty. You know, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was great. I just had a quiet meal with some friends. And it was uneventful, which is, you know, kind of what you want. Just best good kind. Food and great conversation.
That's the best kind, absolutely. Yep. Hey, let's get to our story of the week. We're going to talk about, I don't even know what it means, even after you described it. We're going to talk about same origin problems. All right, Steve, I've got my propeller hat, my virtual propeller hat on.
So we've never discussed this issue of what's called same origin policy. Wikipedia defines it very succinctly. They say the same origin policy is an important security concept for a number of browser-side programming languages such as JavaScript. The policy permits scripts running on pages originating from the same site to access each other's methods and properties with no specific restrictions, but prevents access to most methods and properties across pages on different sites. And what that really means is different origins. This notion of an origin, the origin we're talking about is essentially the web domain, you know, Amazon.com, eBay, PayPal, whatever. And the issue is the safe handling of content that's being served by sites. And increasingly, I guess what the term is mashup is like this notion of a given site that's now providing content from many different places at once. So this is potentially dangerous if it weren't for strict enforcement of the same origin policy, meaning that your browser it receives a web page from the main site that you're visiting, and that web page then requests that other stuff be pulled in to finish out the page from other domains. So the browser goes out and retrieves other stuff from maybe many different domains.
Well, you see this all the time. I mean, even now, almost every page pulls ads from another domain, right?
Right.
Is that an example of it?
That's a perfect example.
Okay.
And what's critical is that the content, whatever it is, if it's a GIF, if it's a JPEG, or Shockwave Flash ad. I mean, we're seeing Shockwave Flash ads all the time. And they can be very powerful. They can be running. There is, you know, ActionScript is the scripting language in Shockwave Flash. And there's a way for ActionScript to invoke JavaScript. So, you know, how I feel about all this scripting going on. But it's crucial that the various components that are coming from different origins not be able to touch each other. That is, that there be individual isolation. Otherwise, there's possibility for something malicious in one of these things sourced from one origin. There would be the possibility for it reaching into and modifying content in a different origin. So this is generally accepted practice. Well, what this one security firm, Foreground Security, a couple weeks ago made a blog posting where they explained that Shockwave Flash's excess permissivity, almost promiscuity, but not quite, the excess permissivity could be abused to essentially render any user-uploaded content dangerous. So SC Magazine, the security magazine, ran the story, researcher finds frighteningly bad Adobe Flash flaw. The Register said Adobe Flash attack vector exploits insecure web design. And then the subtitle was User-Supplied Malware Upload Peril. And even Computer World said Flash flaw puts most sites at risk, or most sites and users at risk, say researchers. And the Computer World story went on to say hackers can exploit a flaw in Adobe's Flash to compromise nearly every website that allows users to upload content, including Google's Gmail, then launch silent attacks on visitors to those sites. Adobe did not dispute the researchers' claims, but said that web designers and administrators have a responsibility to craft their applications and sites to prevent such attacks. And the CTO, the chief tech officer of Foreground Security, was quoted in that story saying, "The magnitude of this is huge." And these guys are based in Orlando, Florida. He said, any site that allows user uploadable content is vulnerable, and most are not configured to prevent this. And then he used the example of a company that lets users upload content to a message forum to explain the process. He said, if the user forum lets people upload an image for their avatar, someone could upload a malicious Flash file that looks like an avatar image. Anyone who then views that avatar would be vulnerable to attack. And in their rebuttal, and this has been, there's like some back and forth going on, Adobe cited Microsoft's 10 immutable laws of security, which Microsoft published back in 2000. Law number 4 is pertains to this, and I love how succinct it is. This is from Microsoft saying this, quote, if you allow a bad guy to upload programs to your website, it's not your website anymore.
Good point.
So what all this boils down to is, and it raises an important point that is really crucial, which is why I wanted to talk about it this week, and that is most sites which do display any content which was uploaded by users are not being safe. and serving that from a different origin domain. That is, most applications, web form applications, online email, you know, all of these things that we refer to as Web 2.0 stuff, which makes the has really, you know, jazzed up the net and is creating all of this interactivity. Anytime you are a web server is, as part of its business, is accepting stuff from users, it is truly crucial and really unappreciated that it must then serve that back from an entirely different domain. And most don't.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
I mean, and it's critical. So the, most
the,
don't.
The safeguard is in there because the domain is different.
Right.
It's a kind of a namespace issue, right? It's like,
it is a name. Yes, yeah. It is exactly a namespace issue. And what this researcher was pointing out, on one hand, is something that Adobe says, well, we all know that. We've always known that. And it's like, but yes, but no one is paying attention to this. And specifically, where Shockwave Flash is a little flaky, having looked at this, in my opinion, is that it is where it's permissive is that you can get Shockwave Flash, the plugin, to parse a file that doesn't have a .swf, a Shockwave Flash file extension. You can stick malicious Shockwave Flash content on the front of an image that ends with JPG or GIF, and if you embed this in a web page, Shockwave Flash will run it. Even though it doesn't have the right file extension, Shockwave looks at the content, the beginning of the content, and if it starts off as a valid Shockwave Flash file, it executes it. And so that allows people to bypass upload restrictions. For example, a site might say, oh, well, we're only going to allow uploads of JPEG images. Well, you can upload a Shockwave Flash object ending with a JPEG extension. And if the browser displays it, the Shockwave Flash plugin can be invoked and run script, where the webmaster never expected script to be run. And so Adobe has said that they cannot make Shockwave Flash behave better. That is, I mean, you could argue this is really broken, that it is this permissive. The other thing that it ignores is the so-called content type header. A content type header is, it tells the browser what type of content the object is. So, for example, it'll say content type colon text slash HTML, which tells the browser this is a text content of HTML. And browsers are smart, and if the file doesn't end in HTML, the browser won't render it because the content it received and the content type don't match. Similarly, you might have a zip file would be content type application slash zip or application slash gzip and so forth. Anyway, again, Shockwave Flash ignores that. And you could argue, wait a minute, I mean, it really should not ignore that. So I would argue that Adobe has some responsibility in the degree to which Shockwave Flash can be abused. They're now saying, because they've sort of been pushed up against the wall, well, we can't change it because it would break everything.
Can I get a clarification? You've been saying Shockwave Flash. Do you mean Shockwave and Flash, or what, are you using Shockwave Flash as a longer term for Flash?
I'm meaning Flash.
Flash,
you're right.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I think it's technically Shockwave Flash, but you mean Flash.
Yes, Flash content.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. So one of the problems is that Flash is, and this was the focus of this posting that got everybody stirred up, is that Flash is too permissive in allowing itself to run Flash files, even when they have a different extension and even when they've got the wrong content header. It's that which allows users, bad guys, to upload malicious content, which will pass the upload filters and then could be served by the server. So that's a problem. But the bigger problem, but this is a sort of a subset or an exploit of a bigger problem, which is that if all user provided content were being served from a completely different domain, and that's the way it should be, then even this wouldn't be a problem. So Adobe is saying, wait a minute, this is really not our problem. This is a problem that people have ignored the same origin issue. They are serving user content, user provided content from the same origin as other stuff, that is, you know, the website's content. And inherently, that allows the user-provided content to interact with scripting that's provided by the site that the user is visiting, and that's really dangerous. So, I mean, I agree with everybody. The real lesson here is, and I'm hoping that webmasters are hearing this, because the problem is it's not easy to fix. I mean, we're talking about having to host all of the stuff that could come from the outside, you know, blog postings, pictures, avatars, content. You know, I mean, there's all of these sites now that are allowing users to upload things. I mean, even Gmail.
It's
for
just
example.
Not the way the web works. I mean, it's you wouldn't want to turn that off.
Well, no, and you can't. I mean, you're right. You can't turn it off now. And the problem is getting to safety from here,
right?
Because if it had always been done correctly, then we wouldn't have a problem. But it hasn't mostly been done correctly. There are some sites, and you know, I scanned past them, and I meant to write them down so I could recite them. But there are sites like professional sites like Hotmail and Yahoo, for example. I don't know that those are two. And I tried to track them down again, and I couldn't find the references, because in this research I ran across major sites that are aware of this, and they definitely serve anything coming from anything that ever originated from other than their webmasters come from a completely different domain. So they did it right. The problem is, you know, that requires every webmaster who's going to be hosting content with, you know, any of these state-of-the-art applications to have two domain names.
Right.
And all of the overhead that goes along with it. I mean, it's a big deal. That's not a simple thing to ask someone to do. It's certainly not simple to ask them to change it now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You, for years, have served your images from one server and your text from another, haven't you? Have you kind of done this?
For a number of different reasons, I've done that. And I do have a number of different domains.
Is that potentially the same problem?
I
mean, I know it's your content, so obviously it's not. But
right.
It is mixed content.
Exactly, yes. And so, for example, and traditionally, for example, I have had images.grc.com and then grc.com. Now, I've folded that back into grc.com/images, and so there were reasons I was doing it once upon a time. Literally, I was serving images from a physically different server just for bandwidth reasons. I realized that, wait, you know, this is crazy for me to be serving images over my T1s back when GRC used to be behind to a pair of T1s. And so Mark Thompson, for example, was for a while hosting images.grc.com just so I could use bandwidth where it made much more sense. So there were a number of things I was doing, but so there I was splitting my content between multiple domains. However, in that case, it was a subdomain, and apparently there are scripting ways to get around subdomain variations so that that's not enough. You can't just say user-supplied-content.mydomain.com versus mydomain.com. You've got to have something like user-supplied-mydomain.com that is a fully different top-level domain and have the content coming from there. Otherwise, you can get scripts to agree on subdomain sharing, having being treated like the same origin, and that's not safe. And so, you know, this is big news for many webmasters who never appreciated the danger. And in fact, the guys that made a big deal about this were reticent to do so because they were able to demonstrate exploits of Flash on many popular sites. And, I mean, they were saying, well, what do we do? We really want to force Adobe to fix this, and their focus really was on Flash. Adobe has said, we're not fixing nothing because we can't change Adobe. We can't change Flash, or it'll make it more restrictive because its permissivity is one of the, you know, it lacks security operation, which is really what it is. It should have been much more standards-based, in which case webmasters would have had to make sure that content headers were correct, and many of these avenues for exploit of this same origin problem would have been cut off. But those are wide open right now. So I mean, by my talking about it and shining additional light on it, I mean, again, this is a problem which is potentially big.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, we know the problems don't go away if you ignore them and if you hide them. And, you know, maybe somehow Adobe could come up with a compromise where they do a version of Flash which can be asked to be more secure.
Right.
And then webmasters can incrementally webmasters who care and want to protect themselves could incrementally require that more secure Flash plugin, which would then propagate over time, and they could protect their site using a Flash player that was able to be more restrictive, able to be asked to be more restrictive. I mean, I don't know what the solution is, but this is a problem. And I recognize that it's potentially big, and it's the problem is it's not easy to fix. It's
well,
you know.
Let me put you on hold, and I mean you must have some prescriptions. I mean, something you'd like to see have happen.
Okay.
I hope you do. I have some thoughts about it too. I mean,
okay.
we're clearly not going to ever get rid of this multi-homed web page problem. So clearly this is a problem, and as I said at the beginning, it's a namespace problem, isn't it? The problem is that web browsers and JavaScript and other web languages kind of don't isolate their code very well.
Right. So to put it simply, and then we'll talk about solutions, there's a clear problem which is created when a page is composed of objects which could be smart, could be scripted, coming from different places. Because traditionally, if scripting came from the same place, that is, different instances of scripting or different parts of scripting, they're inherently able to have visibility into each other.
That's what I was getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. So because of the recognition of the problem, the wizards of the web, always understanding that this was a potential problem, created this notion of same origin, specifying that only content that was served by the same origin, the same web domain, could interact with each other. Otherwise, stuff coming from somewhere else, from a different domain, would inherently be isolated. So, I mean, that was an understood but dramatically underappreciated issue. And the problem is that there's no enforcement. Nobody makes content from users come from somewhere else. And so the de facto, you know, the default is, oh, well, I have, you know, mydomain.com, and I'm going to, and I have an SQL database, and when stuff gets submitted to my site, it goes into my SQL database, which is a back end on my server, and then we're going to have a forum, and so we're going to want to show people what other people have posted.
Right.
And so it's sort of the natural thing to do.
And the presumption is, and this is the mistake, right? If it comes from me, it's safe. If it comes
Correct.
From my domain, it's safe, even though I know it doesn't come from me.
Correct. And so then we say, so the webmaster says, oh, but I don't want people who might be bad people to submit scripts, because then the scripts would go into my database, and then when people viewed a page containing scripts that had been submitted by maybe a bad guy, those scripts coming from my database through my domain, my server, would have equal access to everything else on the site. And that's really bad.
Right.
So the webmaster who's trying to do the right thing says, therefore, I'm a photo sharing site, and I'm only going to allow JPEG uploads or GIF uploads. The problem is that due to the funky way that Flash works, it doesn't care if its script is named .jpeg or .gif. It runs anyway. And so this sort of creates a backdoor that allows scripting to run even though it's identified as an image. And that's really bad.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. But the bigger problem, the more generic problem, is that as Microsoft's law number 4 of Internet security says, if you allow a bad guy to upload programs to your website, it's not your website anymore, which is their way of saying, you know, you really need containment. You really should be sure that inbound content from users goes to a database which is on a different domain. And that, I mean, it's a pain in the butt to do that, because you have to now have, you know, main domain and other domain, and make all the links work and make everything work.
Right. But would that solve it?
That really does solve it, yes, because then all of that content comes from a different origin, and the browser will then enforce this different origin and enforce containment. And then malicious scripting that could have snuck in through some other means won't have access to the main domain's scripting. I mean, you still have the problem that it's, you know, scripting that's running on the user's browser, but it's toned down at least some.
It's a little ironic, because even Google, you know, doesn't do this, and certainly they would have the technology to. Is it difficult to do? I mean...
Yeah. Well, it's not difficult if you did it from day one.
It's hard to do.
Oh, yeah. Retroactively, it would just be a huge nightmare. I mean, all the links in all your pages that referred to content and, I mean, yes, everything would have to get changed around. Yeah. And then you have other sort of little side effects, like browsers might be saying, wait a minute, we don't want cookies. I mean, suddenly now... Those that provided content is a third party. So now you have cookie access problems, because one of the things that you're wanting to restrict is you're wanting to keep bad scripting from having access to the user's session cookies, because we now know that session cookies are used for creating persistent logons. And so you definitely want the bad scripts not, you want to keep them from having access to that. So you want them to be in a separate domain. So that's an example of what maliciously can be done if you're in the same origin. If you're in the same origin, you've got access to the user's cookies. And all kinds of mischief can be made that way. Mm-hmm. So it would be nice if, in the case of Flash, it were much less permissive.
Right.
I can understand them saying, we can't change it now. Unfortunately, you know, it's too late. It would break too many things. Maybe some pressure can be brought on them to allow this to get fixed incrementally for webmasters who are willing to tweak their sites as necessary to run Flash in a more tighter, less permissive way. But the thing I mostly wanted to shine a light on is this whole notion of same origin, because we've never talked about it, which also sort of demonstrates how obscure it is. The fact that we've gone to episode 225, and this is a big deal that, you know, hasn't really come on the radar until now.
Well, it came up because of Flash, but it's more than just Flash. It's been a problem in JavaScript. In fact, I'm sure John Graham Cumming refers to this, this namespace issue. JavaScript can, you know, be confused. I think we even talked about it. Tricked by using common variable names.
Yes, it is. It is one of the things, and that this is where we were talking about it was with John a few weeks ago, and that is the way Adobe defended themselves.
It's not just us. You're all screwed up.
And saying that this is a well-known problem and websites shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
And in fact, Howard Schultz, who's an editor for Sans, in the Sans newsletter, they talked about this. And Howard was the chief security guy at eBay for many years. He was quoted in an editorial that Sans ran saying, who is this Brad Arkin? Brad Arkin was the spokesman at Adobe. He said, who is this Brad Arkin kidding, saying that, quote, sites should not allow user uploads to a trusted domain is completely unrealistic. And so that's Adobe saying, yeah, sites shouldn't do that. It's like, well, okay, but they all do. And so basically Adobe is saying it's not our fault.
Even YouTube does it. I mean, everybody does it.
Yep.
So you're saying if YouTube had a separate server that was, you know, flashyoutube.com, and all the Flash came from there, and all the other content came from youtube.com, that would it wouldn't solve the problem, but it would mitigate it a little bit.
It's not even clear that using a subdomain solves it.
It would have to be completely like FlashYouTube.
FlashTube.com,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Would be where the actual Flash objects lived. Within the YouTube domain.
Right.
So people would go to YouTube, but the things they looked at would be coming from flashtube.com. And there, the completely different domain name would, in the browser, would keep them from ever having any interaction. And today, we don't really have that. I mean, it's all possible. The really high-end professional sites understand this, and they do it. But most sites don't.
Yeah.
And I'll bet you we'll be doing a podcast here before long talking about, you know, some bad consequence of this.
Right. Is there anything that the end user can do? I mean, are there any settings you could set in your browser that make it, I guess not, because it can't tell. It all comes from the same place.
There were, among all of this skirmish, people saying, well,
the browser should solve it.
You could turn off Flash.
Thanks
a lot. Yeah, I mean, you know, talk about dead websites.
Yeah.
And there's a toggle Flash add-on for IE, and NoScript offers Flash suppression, or like Flash on Demand, where it just shows you sort of an F, and then you click on it if you want to run it. So that's something I've seen NoScript doing.
Yep.
But again, we've become so dependent upon Flash for so much. And again, it happens to be one too readily exploitable vector of this problem, but it's not really the problem. The real problem is that you know, as Brad Arkin at Adobe unrealistically suggests, sites should not allow user uploads to a trusted domain. I was like, well, okay, good luck with that. The sites are going to.
You know, somebody's pointing out in the chat room, and I've just been playing with YouTube a little bit. YouTube does do some of that. They have a server called ytimg.com, where thumbnails come from anyway. I don't know if the Flash comes from there or not. That's very clever. So maybe they are doing something like that.
It's really, I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised if sites that are really on their game have, I mean, where there's a lot at stake, they've said, okay, well, you know, their webmasters really understand. And here's the problem is that, you know, so many sites these days are canned. You buy some blogging app or some foreign app and you just stick it in. And, you know, you run it on yourdomain.com, and there's no concept of this whole same origin policy issue. It just isn't there.
Right.
Someday this problem will get solved, like so many other ones we talk about.
And blocking Flash alone, although I do that, there's a Flash block script, and there's a Safari plugin, which I use, called Click to Flash. So I do that, but I do it more because I don't want Flash animations to start playing while we're doing the show when I go to a site. But there are ways to do that. But that's not enough because that's just Flash. And now that there's the same problem occurs with JavaScript and other.
Well, and I use a very nice add-on for Firefox, AdBlock Plus.
Right.
And
that's very expensive.
My goodness, yeah. It's so nice. You just don't have, you know, fish jumping around your page when you go somewhere or you know, people, you know, just really annoying things flashing at you and trying to get your attention. It just quiets all that down. So that also would protect you in a nice way.
Right. Steve, I'm glad we did talk about this. It's funny that, you know, this has been around forever, but this is the first time we've talked about same origin problems. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. Now, that's his website. You can go there to find this podcast, of course, both 16 and 64 kilobit versions, depending on your bandwidth capabilities. There's also a transcription, so you can read along as you listen, and show notes, too. It's all at grc.com. We have a feedback episode next week, so if you want to leave a question about this or any other security topic, go to grc.com/feedback. And while you're there, just, you know, pick up a copy of SpinRite. You never know when you'll need some hard drive recovery or maintenance. grc.com. Steve, I can't wait to talk to you next week.
Thanks, Leo. We'll do it in 7 days.